Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Dennis Knows History. A short while ago, I said something real stupid on Twitter. It was about Irish history. There was a massive pile-on. I got cancelled. So what I decided to do was talk to Finn Duar, who is in charge of the wonderful Irish History podcast, and we sat and we worked it out. We worked out what is the right way to talk about the Irish War of Independence, which foolishly I described as a civil war within the United Kingdom, of which Ireland was a part. But as Finn describes to me, it was a reluctant and unequal part, and therefore the terminology of civil war is not helpful, useful in this case. This is what it's all about. Step away from social media, have actual conversations with people, make new friends. It was a very cool experience. The Irish History Podcast, you don't listen to it, it's a wonderful thing. I'm a regular listener. Go and check it out. At the moment, they've got wonderful partisans stories on, Irish stories from the Spanish Civil War. And we've also got Spanish Civil War coming up on this podcast as well. It was great talking to Finn. It's a big anniversary following the First World War. The British and Irish battled for control of the island of Ireland with enduring political, social and economic effects, which we're all talking about at the moment. Let's face it, this is contemporary stuff, everybody, like all the best history. Right, if you want to watch programs on our new digital history channel, please do so. If you use code POD6, P-O-D-6, when you go to historyhit.tv, you get 6 weeks free access to the world's best history channel. It's awesome. It's so exciting. We built a history channel, everyone. It's working. We got subscribers on every continent. I'm not sure in Antarctica. If there are any, let me know. But every other continent, we got them. It's such an honour to be part of. Thank you very much. Thank you also for rating this podcast 5 stars and all that rubbish. Much appreciated. If you want, you're listening to this before the end of February 2020, you can enter our special competition to win a huge, wonderful trip to Guernsey to look at all the Second World War stuff out there. So if you go to historyhit.com/visit Guernsey, you've got a day or two to enter. It closes at the end of February 2020. In the meantime, everybody, here's the wonderful Finn Duar from the Irish History Podcast. Enjoy. Finn, thank you very much for coming on the podcast and setting me straight.
Thanks very much for having me on.
So tell me, let's get started with a bit of the history. What was going on 100 years ago now in the winter and spring in Ireland?
Ireland was about to enter, I suppose, the key phase in the Irish War of Independence, which was obviously going to... The aim of the war was to break most of Ireland, or what would be most of Ireland at the time. People had hoped for the entire island to break free of the United Kingdom. I suppose to explain to people maybe a bit, it might be worth just setting a bit of the scene in the build-up to it, in that Ireland had become part of the United Kingdom in 1800 through the Act of Union, which came into effect the following year. But over the following century, there was various attempts to try and bring Ireland properly into that union, but they failed repeatedly. Events like the Great Hunger, the famine of the 1840s had a huge impact in Ireland, and it had a terrible legacy where you have a majority of the Irish population feeling alienated from the United Kingdom and certainly not part of it in the way that obviously, say, people in England would have felt that they belonged to that kingdom. There was also other issues like religion obviously separated the majority, about 80% of the Irish population from 80% of the Irish population being Catholic in what was constitutionally a Protestant kingdom, obviously created this gap. But a lot of this crystallises, I suppose, and the tensions that have built up around poverty in Ireland and other issues crystallise around the First World War, and a key event during that war in Ireland being the Easter Rising, where a small group of rebels rise up in opposition to British rule in Ireland. They're actually deeply unpopular at the time, but the reaction of the British government, which is overly oppressive to these rebels, swings in support of them. And then general opposition to World War One in the country cements support for these rebels. I don't know if that might explain a bit of the, I suppose, building resentment, because I suppose it's important to recognise that the Irish War of Independence didn't fall from the sky. There was a lot more than what I've talked about there, but it's a series of building tensions that essentially build up over arguably 100 years, if not more.
In the 19th century, when Irish voters are sending their MPs to Parliament, they're not voting for quote-unquote British parties, are they? I mean, they're sending representatives of distinctly Irish political parties to represent them in Westminster.
Yeah, so I suppose there's various different embodiments of this, but by the late 19th century, what you get is two main political parties, one being the Irish Parliamentary Party in favour of Home Rule. That's, I suppose, devolved government. Ireland would have stayed within the Union under those terms. And then you have the Unionists, Irish Unionists, who believe in the closest possible ties to Britain and England, and those, they dominate politics. Now, in the early 20th century, that changes, where the Home Rule or nationalist movement is replaced by a more republican organisation, which doesn't see Home Rule or a devolved parliament as enough. What they want is independence.
That's so fascinating. So you mentioned the First World War. Is it the war? Is it the response to the Easter Uprising in particular? What is going on that turns people from home rulers to republicans to separatists, whatever the word is in that period?
That journey is influenced by lots of different things. I do think some of those issues that I pointed out, the historical tension does influence it, but that's only a stage. And the First World War, though, is the catalyst. And like in so many countries around Europe, it does transform politics. There are events that really have a huge impact in Ireland, one of them being the conscription crisis of 1918. Ireland hadn't been subject to conscription, but in 1918, as Britain faced a manpower shortage, there was a threat to introduce conscription into Ireland. Pretty much all aspects of the nationalist movement, either home rulers or republicans, opposed this. But I think it's fair to say it was the republican movement which catalysed on this growing opposition that Irish people didn't want to go, or certainly large sections of the Irish population felt that war had very little to do with them. I should also say you also have a very strong labour movement at this point that organises a general strike against introducing conscription into Ireland. And ultimately, conscription, even though it was voted through Parliament, wasn't introduced into Ireland. So that, I suppose, creates a growing climate. Then the famous election of 1918, sees Republicans or nationalists in Sinn Féin sweep the boards in terms of nationalist politics in Ireland, and they come to power. And that, I suppose, is a reflection of this transformation that has gone on. The Home Rule Party, who had been in favour of devolved government, had backed World War One quite disastrously, sending thousands of Irish people to die on the Western Front. And they had been affected by that. So yeah, the First World War is part of this, is the catalyst. And obviously all the other changes that go on in that war, that spring from that war, the social changes as well. You have the emergence of lots of other movements, including a women's movement as well, that's somewhat tied into this as well. But Irish society is dramatically changed by that. So by early 1919, you have Sinn Féin politicians, Republicans, who have said in their manifesto that they will not go to Westminster, but instead will convene a parliament in Dublin. And they do that in January 1919. And on the same day, two policemen are shot in South Tipperary, which is considered to be the opening shots of the Irish War of Independence. So that period of January 1919, after the election of December 1918, where you have, I suppose, the political wing striking out for independence, but you also have Irish volunteers in a striking out on, a military, starting effectively what's recognised as the start of the military campaign as well.
And so quite rapidly, the nationalists, the freedom fighters, that they take over, particularly the countryside, do they? They make it almost untenable for central government to have its agents in the countryside.
Pretty much. Like, I think if you were in Ireland in 1919, the opening stage of the war is almost like it's not a full-scale war by any means. You're having policemen targeted, but over that year it increases in intensity. What you have is things like rural police stations being attacked, then eventually evacuated, and after they're evacuated, what is becoming or devolving or evolving into the IRA, Irish Republican Army, burns down these RIC barracks. So essentially the British presence through this police force evaporates in huge, as you say, sections of the countryside. Now, this does create a problem in that the police withdraw into the cities. The IRA are never, during at any point in the War of Independence, strong enough to drive the, you might call it, into the sea, you know, a full like withdrawal of the British presence in Ireland from a military perspective is never really on the cards. But what they are doing very successfully is making rule in Ireland impossible. So huge swathes of the country are no longer really under the control of the government in London. Side by side with that, though, the Republican movement have done lots of other things. They've set up their own infrastructure of government. They're holding courts. And there's basically, you've got two systems of government. And then what is a key part of this, and I suppose is often written out of it, is the role again of the labour movement in the later stage of 1920 as the war is really intensifying. They launch a strike on the transport workers, refuse to handle war goods. So the British Army have huge problems. Now, the war is largely being fought, I should say, by the various aspects of the police, the RIC, and then two branches, I suppose, within that, the notorious, I don't know if people have ever heard of them, the Black and Tans, a quasi-paramilitary force sent to Ireland, and then the auxiliaries, another force raised and sent to Ireland. And these are the groups that largely fight the war.
What about the sectarianism that we hear about in Ireland? Because was there also sectarian tensions here between communities of Catholics and Protestants around Ireland, but I guess particularly towards into the north, into the province of Ulster?
Yeah, so the war, like any war, varies from place to place, region to region, and is influenced by local dynamics on community. But certainly in the northeast in particular, so like Ulster comprises of the nine northern counties, but certainly in the northeast where you've got a higher concentration, say, of Protestants than maybe in other parts of the country, tensions certainly arise. You have this, it's not just because there's large numbers of Protestants. These communities tend to be unionist in outlook. And actually Ireland, it's worth saying, is partitioned in 1920 in the middle of the war. It's a very complicated story, but this kind of highlights the fact that there's actually, I suppose, in a way, two wars going on. But to come back to your point, yeah, there's a very sectarian nature of the war in particularly in Belfast, where thousands, for example, of Catholic workers are driven out of the shipyards, the big employer in Belfast at the time. You have very serious sectarian murders as well on both sides, it should be said. Whereas in other parts of the country, it tends to maybe follow more of a, I suppose, a political war in the sense that you have members of the IRA attacking the police, whereas in parts of Ulster, for example, in the northeast in particular, you do have this more sectarian nature to the war, where you have the Ulster Volunteer Force and the IRA in what is often just dismissed as riots in papers at the time, but is much more a sectarian war. But it shouldn't be, I guess, as well, that shouldn't be overstated in terms of the wider war across the island.
So in terms of this wider war, what kind of military operations are we talking about in rural counties like, you know, Tipperary, Mayo, some of that? So not in what is now the north, Northern Ireland. How big are these? Are army units moving in? Are they taking? Is it like a counterinsurgency, like you might see in, you know, Afghanistan today, or is it policing actions, constant attacks on the police, driving the police out of rural areas?
it varies massively. Certainly towards the end of the war, you start to get, on both sides, it should be said, much larger scale operations. But there are, as the British, I suppose, military apparatus through the police, army, etc., withdraw into the cities, what they then have to do are these very huge sweeps through the countryside in what I suppose it's quite ineffective ultimately, because they're not, you know, they're moving through an area that might only pass through it every second week or something. They're obviously, very obviously coming. You know, people can see them arriving in advance, so they're not really that effective. That said, this what is generally regarded as a huge mistake of this, I suppose if you want to call it the counterinsurgency operation from the British point of view, is that the war is waged against the population. So several towns are burned. Cork City, for example, is burned. The Lord Mayor of Cork, Tomás McCurtain, is shot dead by members of the RIC. And this man is a democratically elected mayor. It would be like if the mayor of London or Manchester or somewhere like that was shot dead. There are numerous cases of innocent people being shot. So the war becomes, I suppose, if you want to call it a very dirty war, but obviously as well, when this starts to happen, it's counterproductive, because what you have is the war is being exacted against the population, and naturally the reaction of the population is to move in favour, even more so, of the Republican movement. It also has a disastrous impact, I think, in England as well, where because Ireland is so close, these, say, for example, in other parts of the empire at the time, say, for example, Kenya or further afield, newspaper reporters couldn't really get there and get the story back. But for example, the town of Balbriggan is burned, and Balbriggan is only outside Dublin. So a journalist, say from the Manchester Guardian, can come to Dublin, go out to Balbriggan and write a story and have it submitted, say, within 24 hours. So this makes the war and some of these atrocities that are carried out in the war, the British public find out about these very quickly. And this certainly, I think, does hamper the British war effort in terms of if they had wanted to escalate the war. Now, there are other factors, like the fact that Ireland was part of the United Kingdom, and World War One obviously had just come to an end, so the appetite in Britain for another war is quite limited.
So obviously, you know, I got in massive trouble. I was burned out of Twitter for about 48 hours for suggesting it's a civil war, because that term implies that Ireland and Britain were part of the same unitary state, the UK, which of course on paper they were, but it seems legitimate by many living in Ireland. Totally accept that. But is there a sense in which the British people also went, this is a war of colonial aggression? Were the British electorate quite, what was their view? Is it possible to judge what their view on this ongoing war in Ireland was?
I think that varies massively. There is a feature, obviously, of Irish emigration to Britain, which had continually happened since the Great Famine ended in the early 1850s. You have this continuous wave of emigration from Ireland. The population around the time of the War of Independence is in and around 4 million people. Prior to the famine, it had been 8.5 million. So you have this constant stream out of Ireland. So you have communities in England that have this sympathy. There were big arson attacks in England carried out by the IRA in later 1920. Which obviously bring the war. Now, that doesn't mean, I'm not in any way saying that there's a sympathy among the wider population. That said, though, in terms of this issue of the, was it a civil war, it is interesting that several British politicians, and you can see this continuously through the later 19th century, definitely refer to Ireland as being this problem that comes on the desk of a British Prime Minister in a way that I don't think they would talk about. Like Churchill talks about it in the House of Commons in 1922, that this Irish problem continually comes onto the desk of this great nation, but this great nation being Britain, not the United Kingdom. And I think you can't really look at it as a civil war. Again, it comes back to this issue of when Ireland was brought into the Union. So this happened, as I said at the start there, in 1801. But Ireland was essentially ruled through coercion for the entire century. So between 1801 and when the 26 counties in Ireland gained partial independence in early 1922, there's over 100 coercion acts, which effectively suspend habeas corpus and most rights that are, and these are introduced continually through the 19th century. And that's how Ireland is ruled. And that is indicative, not just of a nationalist sentiment, because that's too simplistic, but of the wider problems in Irish society. Ireland was much poorer than the rest of the United Kingdom. Ireland was looked down on, and there's no question about that in terms of a... It's worth bearing in mind that in the early 20th century, the world was even more racialized than it is today, I think, and that Irish people were definitely seen as lower down on that pecking order than people in Britain. And you can see that in, for like, the most notorious examples of that are Punch magazine, which carries horrifically racist depictions of Irish people. But what I'm getting at here is that I don't think, for all these reasons, that Ireland was really seen as part of the United Kingdom. And I think certainly in Ireland, a large number of the population saw Ireland, and obviously this would change over time, but Ireland was unquestionably different.
Yes, it's,
Well,
no, it's really interesting you say that, because of course a lot of the polling around Brexit suggests that the British people aren't that fussed if British Brexiteers aren't that fussed if it forces Northern Ireland out of the UK. You know, the UK feels, even with 100 years more maturity than it did in 1920, it still feels like a kind of legal entity rather than a coherent nation state, even today. And I can imagine, obviously, 100 years back, it had only existed for a much shorter amount of time, and even more people within it didn't want to be in it. So therefore, it's more like an Algerian-French union, which was, you know, never a union realised on the ground.
Yeah, for sure. I think... Like, I suppose I was actually thinking about this before we talked, and I think maybe for people in Britain to get a sense of it, one thing I was thinking about it in the context of Brexit, and it's like nearly 50 years since people in Britain joined the European Union. But judging on the conversations that happened around Brexit, very few people in Britain ever saw themselves as being part of that. And I suppose Ireland being part of the Union is only twice as long as that. So maybe that might help people get that, as you're saying, it's very much a legalistic. There are obviously, and I'm sure it's the same around Brexit, there are people who did see themselves as being part of the United Kingdom. We're very proud of that fact, and it's very important to recognise that these were Irish people. But they were a minority, I think. And you can see that through most elections. As Ireland gains a democratic system through the 19th century, it tends to be people who favour more autonomy of various different kinds, be it home rule or ultimately independence, tend to dominate those elections.
Have you ever wondered if the Hanging Gardens of Babylon were actually real? Or what made Alexander so great? Join me, Tristan Hughes, twice a week, every week on the Ancients from History Hit, where I'm joined by leading academics, best-selling authors, and world-class archaeologists to shine a light on some of ancient history's most fascinating questions, like who built Stonehenge and why? What are the Dead Sea Scrolls and why are they so valuable? And were the Spartan warriors really as formidable as the history books say? Join me, Tristan Hughes, twice a week, every week on the Ancients from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
We finished the story, and so in 1920, Ireland is partitioned. It's obviously insanely complicated, but the War of Independence in the, what would become the South, the Republic of Ireland, sort of comes to an end, is replaced by a different kind of war, tell the audience what the British government effectively give in and make a deal that if they can retain these northern counties of Ulster with their larger population of Protestants, that the South can, although there's a fudge, it doesn't become a republic immediately, does it?
No, I think what is important is during the war, the British government are adamant that the situation of Ulster will be resolved before they deal with the republican movement. And it's Lloyd George recognises quite early on that they're going to have to at some point talk to Sinn Féin and the IRA, that there's going to have to be a political solution to this war. They can control the cities, but the IRA will largely control the countryside. So they do resolve the situation in Ulster through introducing two home rule parliaments, one in Belfast and one in Dublin. The one in Belfast is established. The one in Dublin never takes off because most of the electorate representatives refuse to sit in it. But after that happens, in the summer of 1921, you have a truce. That leads to negotiations that happen in London in late 1921, and that leads to the treaty. Now, the treaty gives huge rights, a huge amount of independence, rather, to Ireland. But what's crucial is that Ireland is not fully independent. And when I say Ireland, I'm referring to the 26 southern counties. By this point, the six northeastern counties of Ulster, or six of the nine northeastern counties of Ulster, have become part of what is now Northern Ireland. And what you have is Ireland has, as I say, increased rights, but it gets dominion status, essentially. And this is one of the contributing reasons to factors that leads to a civil war in Ireland, because the IRA splits over this, over whether this is truly independence. Is this what they were fighting for? The IRA splits over that issue, and you have a civil war in Ireland between 1922 that into early 1924, although the intense period of fighting ends in 1923.
So speaking of civil war, let's talk about why it provoked such anger when I tweeted that the UK experienced civil war 100 years ago. I guess it's, you know, people... If you refuse to accept the UK was a legitimate entity, it's you know, you don't therefore accept that it's a civil war, because it's a war of a war of fighting for freedom. It's a war against colonial oppression, against imperialism.
Yeah, like I think it is back to this issue of, like, Ireland's status in the Union was always questionable. Why was it there? It had been brought in, as I say, under force. I think a good example as well is, say, for example, Scotland being the other country that's part, because Wales, I suppose, has a very, very long historic connection. But Scotland being brought in 1707. Prior to that, you had a king of Scotland that had become king of England. I think it's absolutely unimaginable, though, that you would have had a king of Ireland that could become a king of England. I think Ireland occupied this very different place, partly due to religion, partly due to other cultural differences. But there is this... issue, I think, and I don't think it's just an Irish issue. I think in Britain as well, Ireland was not seen as an equal part of the Union. Theoretically, like, Dublin was the same as Liverpool or Manchester or Glasgow or Edinburgh. In reality, though, it was very different. And certainly then when you went outside Dublin, that was amplified. And events like the Great Famine certainly reinforced this issue in Irish people's minds, where the British government, at the best reading of events, reacted very slowly to that, and then when they did intervene, arguably made the situation worse. Now, people have always argued in Ireland, and most historians, I think, would accept, that had that been happening, say, in the home counties, the reaction would have been very different. And I guess what I'm getting at here is that Ireland's place within the Union was never really more than... It had never been incorporated properly. It had always been... It was on both sides, somewhat different.
It was a sort of legal, as I say, like France incorporating "quote unquote" Algeria as part of France. It doesn't. It actually is a. No, that totally makes sense. But I was amazed, because I received, you know, hate tweets from Sinn Féin politicians. I felt I'd arrived, because by using the term civil war, I implied that the British and Irish were part of a single political entity that ended up fighting each other, of course, with a separatist agenda, like in Sri Lanka, the Sri Lankan civil war. It's both a civil war and a freedom fight. And I was amazed at the strength of feeling. Well, I wasn't that amazed. I've got a lot, you know, I know Alan pretty well, but I was, you know, pretty surprised at the strength of feeling. And people saying this is like, this is after 100 years, you still can't accept the outcome of this work, which was astonishing to me, you know, because I obviously do accept the outcome. And indeed, you know, ongoing issues around the state of Northern Ireland is an issue for, you know, people living there and on the island of Ireland. So, but it's something that, you know, I touched an extreme. Can you try and explain to people who might, you know, who don't come from that culture, like why is the naming of those wars so important?
Well, I think probably it goes back to the fact that Ireland is an independent country today. A civil war might imply that maybe Ireland should be part of the Union. Whereas I think a majority of Irish people, and judging on polls, there's an increasing feeling that Ireland should be unified and an independent country. I think probably what some of it may have to do with, though, is also a lot of the conversations around Brexit in England illustrated what really surprised a lot of people in Ireland, how little people in England had any idea.
Oh,
like,
God,
for
yeah.
example,
absolutely.
Not just, like, you know, if someone in general public doesn't know very much about Ireland, I don't have an issue maybe, you know, really with that. What I do have, and what most Irish people did have an issue, is that very, very senior politicians in Britain didn't understand, like Dominic Raab saying he hadn't read the Good Friday Agreement. That really made people go, like, do you know anything about this country? Do you know anything about the nature of the conflict that has gone on in Ireland or in the north over the last 40, 50 years, and then historically, obviously, what we've been talking about. And I think those issues have maybe brought a lot of this to the fore in Ireland in terms of like how we see ourselves, and very much though how people in Britain see Ireland, and that have a lot of the comments are like Priti Patel's comment about starving the Irish into submission, which was like, do you not know anything about this, the history of this country? And I don't know if anyone could have said anything more insensitive than that comment about talking about food and Ireland in terms of this was around the negotiations of the backstop. And I think these things, as I say, brought to the fore in Ireland, maybe the lack of understanding. And I think people in Ireland have a much better understanding of history in Britain. That's for obvious reasons. But I think this is related a bit to maybe what we're talking about, is that like the two countries, for lots of reasons, are quite different. And because Ireland was forced to be brought into the Union for 120 years odd, that probably didn't really ever change the fact, you know.
No, I think, listen, I think people in Britain, I think people in England in particular, are blind to Ireland. I think it's remarkable. I think if you go into a pub and ask 100 people what's the closest European country to the UK, I think 80% of them would say France. And it's just a source of constant amazement. However, as a man who's applying for an Irish passport at the moment, I say good riddance to those damned Englishmen. Thank you. Thank you very much for coming setting me straight. I look forward to having a pint with you next time I'm in Ireland, and we can continue the conversation.
Great stuff. Give me a shout.
Let's tell everyone about your podcast, which is totally brilliant, annoyingly brilliant. People listen to yours instead of mine. It's infuriating. So tell everyone where they can find it.
It's the Irish History Podcast, and you can find it at irishhistorypodcast.ie. And there's lots of podcasts about everything I've been talking about here, including things like the Great Famine and lots of other interesting chapters about Irish history.
Yep, that's great, Finn. Keep it up. Doing lots of fantastic things there. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast. Really appreciate that. And perhaps we'll talk again, because we've got a lot of big anniversaries coming up over the next few months and years, which define the ongoing relationship between Britain and Ireland.
Great stuff. Thanks very much, Dan.
Thanks, man.
I feel the hand of history upon our shoulders.
All this tradition of ours, our school history, our songs, this part of the history of our country, all were gone and finished.
One child, one teacher, one book, and one pen can change the world.
He tells us what is possible, not just in the pages of history books, but in our own lives as well.
I have faith in you.
Hope you enjoyed the podcast. Just before you go, bit of a favour to ask. I totally understand if you don't want to become a subscriber or pay me any cash money. Makes sense. But if you could just do me a favour, it's for free. Go to iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. If you give it a 5-star rating and give it an absolutely glowing review, purge yourself, give it a glowing review. I'd really appreciate that. It's a tough world out there. Law of the jungle out there. And I need all the fire support I can get. So that will boost it up the charts. It's so tiresome. But if you could do it, I'd be very, very grateful. Thank you.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History It. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favor. Don't forget, you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW. At checkout.